And I want to continue today in going through some of the histories of Josephus in regard to the destruction of Jerusalem's temple, and for that matter, the entire city, in the year AD 70. I had mentioned at the beginning of last program, and had also taught way back many, many lessons ago, that the Olivet Discourse was a prediction by Jesus largely in regard to the destruction of the temple. Jesus had warned only a matter of days prior to arriving in Jerusalem that the temple was going to be destroyed. On the day of his triumphal entry, while everyone else was celebrating, he was crying. And he cited again that it was going to be destroyed, that not one stone was going to be left upon another. And then just a couple of days before his crucifixion, his disciples were pointing out all the magnificent sights to see in the building complex, in the temple building complex. And his response was, "You see all these things? There's not going to be one stone left upon another. All are going to be pulled down." The disciples came and asked him about his statement. They had connected it with pretty much the end of the world as we know it, the beginning of eternity, when the righteous would be resurrected from the dead or transformed in their living, and the Messiah would reign from Jerusalem forever. So they asked their question based on that, but it ended up actually being two questions, one about the destruction of the temple and the other about Jesus' return. And he does get around to talking about his return in the Olivet Discourse. He cites that no one knows that day or that hour, that it'll come like a thief in the night. But in regard to the destruction of the temple, he gives some very precise, very detailed commentary. And one of the things that he gave them was the trigger event that the Israeli believers in himself could look for, which would tell them to get out of Jerusalem, to abandon it, because its desolation was near. Now, commonly, when teachers, prophecy teachers, deal with this topic, they go to the Matthew 24 passage and talk about the abomination of desolation. But I have very much tried to get people to realize Luke chapter 21, verse 20, is the biblical commentary on that comment by Jesus. Luke was writing as a Gentile, trying to make things more clear. And this is what he said about the abomination of desolation. Luke 21, 20. "When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must not enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. And woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress upon this land," talking about Israel and particularly Jerusalem, "and wrath to this people," speaking about the Israeli ethnic group, "and they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled." And that's basically the church era. That will end when Jesus Christ returns. And so we're still in it, and Jerusalem is still pretty much in control of those who are non-Jews. Yes, technically, the Israelis have control of the Temple Mount, but they don't exercise that control, so it's not really control, is it? There's not a single Israeli that could feel safe trying to walk up on the Temple Mount at this point, and so they don't have control of it. It's still being trampled underfoot by non-Israelis or Gentiles. reason why this is so important that I go over the historical account is to show that everything Jesus said in his Olivet Discourse about the destruction of Jerusalem happened just like he said, right down to his comments that this would be the beginning of a huge tribulation. In fact, this would be a tribulation unlike anything that had happened before or anything that would happen again. It is a very common for prophecy teachers to say that that couldn't be applied to the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70 because there's been lots worse tragedies happen since then. I would suggest to you that that is not true. Think about what the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple in particular represented. According to Jesus and according to the prophetic word leading up to the time of Jesus, when the Jewish nation as a group and Jewish people as individuals rejected Jesus as their Messiah, they rejected the new covenant, which was actually a fulfillment of the old. Having rejected that, they left themselves with no means of salvation. Because it was God's intention all along, having brought the Messiah into the world, to save, through his atonement, anyone who would put their faith in him. And that the old covenant, with its blood sacrifices, which could not atone for sin without the completing sacrifice of Christ, that all of those rituals, all of the things going on in the temple would pass away. The book of Hebrews makes a very huge point on this. And so when the temple was destroyed in AD 70, that was the removal of the last vestiges of the redundant old covenant, a covenant that had finally been fulfilled in Christ and therefore could be retired. There is salvation no longer in any of the old covenant rituals. Even if a new temple were to be rebuilt today, God would not be pleased, nor would he recognize any of the old covenant sacrifices offered in it, because that covenant is no longer available for use. And so the destruction of the temple was the low point, I suppose we might say, in the lives of so many ethnic Israelis who thought they still had a relationship with God because they had held on to the old covenant, when in real fact they had no relationship with God because they had no relationship with his Messiah whom they had rejected. And so they are people who have the form of some sort of religion and relationship, but who have no real religion or relationship. And it is a tremendous tragedy when you look at it. And all of the death and destruction is just going to add to that. We are going to quote from some of the passages in Josephus' account today, and you will see it was a horrendous time. And if you think about the population figures between the first century Jewish world population and the casualties of this war, and compare it to the world population of Jewish people living at the time of the Holocaust and the casualties that took place during those years of World War II and leading up to World War II, the percentage of Israelis who died during the 4 to 6 years of the Jewish war surrounding the destruction of the temple surpasses the percentage of Jewish people who died during the Holocaust. That's how significant this is. Yesterday, I went over the understanding that the war blew up because of a very horrendous Roman prefect who took over in Judea and pushed the population until they finally pushed back. And as things began to spiral out of control, ethnic fighting blew up all over the nation of Judea and even into Galilee and Samaria and all over what we now term the Holy Land. Exactly as Jesus said, that there would be wars and sounds of wars and nation or ethnic group rising against nation and kingdom against kingdom. All of that, exactly as he described, was what happened starting in AD 66. When the 12th Roman Legion was pretty much wiped out by the Jewish rebels in that year, AD 66, it sealed the fate of what would happen next. There was no way that Rome could not answer that. But from the Christian's point of view, from the believers in Jesus who were Israeli by ethnicity, who were still habitually worshiping at Jerusalem, when they saw the Roman legion's camp go up outside of Jerusalem, this abomination that would make desolate, just exactly as Jesus predicted, they took the opportunity to escape. Cestius, who was the legate of Syria, waited for 3 days before commencing his military operation against the city. And so during those 3 days after he established his camp on Mount Scopus, the Jewish believers in Jesus escaped. And the tradition says that not a single believer died there. That goes very much with what Jesus predicted, that unless God cut short the days or kept them under control, there wouldn't be anyone saved. There was a huge number of people who died in the Jerusalem rebellion and in the destruction of the city. Most of them not by Roman hands, but by Jewish. And if it weren't for the sake of the elect, God would not have allowed a single person to survive that. That's what Jesus basically said. The Emperor Nero dispatched a man by the name of Vespasian, you know, to put down this rebellion. Vespasian began his military operations later in 66, maybe into the later winter of early 67 by our calendar. And by the spring of 69, he had put down most of the Jewish rebellion in the outlying areas. Most of the troublemakers had retreated back into Jerusalem, and they fought amongst themselves. As I cited yesterday, it was during this time period that Vespasian found out that there was a civil war going on back at Rome. There was a fight over who was going to replace Nero. And he eventually put his hat in the ring as well and marched away from Jerusalem in order to take charge of that. Left his son Titus to take care of things while he was gone. But they basically just kept things bottled up in Jerusalem during that time period because he wanted to, that is, Vespasian wanted to focus his attention on more pressing Roman politics. During the intervening years, you should understand that Jerusalem was a seething pot of unrest. Israelis were killing Israelis all over the place. It was also happening out in the country. A couple of the things that Josephus refers to, and he was an eyewitness of these things, is that the Dead Sea had dead bodies bobbing up and down all through it from where they had washed down from the Jordan Valley, from where they had washed down from, you know, the wadis, the wet weather streams, where they had been killed. Just bodies everywhere. I want to read to you just a little something that was going on in Jerusalem itself. It says that the zealots, however, carried barbarity so far as to grant internment to none. That is, he wouldn't let anyone bury anyone else, whether slain within the city or on the roads. But as though they had covenanted to annul the laws of nature along with those of their country, and their outrages upon humanity to add pollution of heaven itself, they left the dead putrefying in the sun. For burying a relative, as for desertion, the penalty was death. And one who granted his boon to another instantly stood in need of it himself. In short, none of the nobler emotions was so utterly lost amid the miseries of those days as pity. Now that reminded me when I read it of Jesus' comments that love would grow cold during this time that was going to bring about the destruction of the temple when not one stone was going to be left upon another. In another passage, and I'm reading, by the way, from Josephus's War. This is his many-volume account of the Jewish War. He was an eyewitness to it and spoke with many of the eyewitnesses of the things that he didn't see personally but was aware of. There was a period where many Jewish people kept trying to escape to the Roman lines because they understood that the Romans wanted to try to regain order. And whenever these people tried to escape from Jerusalem, the Jewish insurgents, the Jewish troublemakers, would search them and steal from them any wealth that they might be trying to take out with them. And the thing was that many of these people would swallow their coins in order to sneak them out. And some non-regular Roman army draftees, Arabs and Syrians, who didn't really particularly care for the Jewish people already, they caught someone going through their fecal matter to try to retrieve these coins, found out what had happened, and started butchering people right and left. And only by Titus threatening them with execution could he restrain this inappropriate, unprofessional behavior of his auxiliary soldiers. And Josephus reports that even with that threat of capital punishment, some of these auxiliaries continued the practice of killing people just to see whether or not they'd swallowed gold pieces. In another passage, he reports that some of the witnesses who came out told him, and here's the quote, they reported that there were carried out through a single gate which had been entrusted to him 115,880 corpses between the 14th day of the month Zixthanis, on which the general encamped before the walls, and the new moon of Panaeus. Or Panemus. That'd basically be a 2.5 month period from the time that Titus threw up his cordon around the city of Jerusalem. 115,000 plus corpses. Another one reported that the corpses of the lower classes were thrown out through the gates, amounting to about 600,000. And they were basically shutting dead bodies in great big houses. They were just stacking them in like cordwood because there were so many dead bodies. Now, Josephus, at the beginning of Book 6, has a fairly long comment that gives an idea of how horrible it was. I'm not going to read all of it, but I'm going to read some of it here. With hands imbrued with the blood of their countrymen, this is talking about the insurgents, they rushed forth to war with the foreigner, upbraiding the deity, so I cannot but think, for his tardiness in punishing them, for it was no hope of victory but despair of escape which now nerved them to the battle. And so they didn't care about God. They were basically yelling about God. They didn't trust God any longer. There is another passage where Josephus is being used by the Romans to try to appeal to the leadership of the troublemakers among the Jews to simply give up, to cease their rebellion, and there would be a general amnesty, and that all this could be put behind. And this is one of the things that he said. Very sarcastically, he says, "Pure indeed have you kept it for God. The holy place too remains undefiled. Your looked-for ally has suffered no impiety from you and still receives his customary sacrifices." He was talking about the fact that the sacrifices had been stopped. They couldn't keep them up. "Most impious wretch, should anyone deprive you of your daily food, you would consider him an enemy. And do you hope to have God, whom you have bereft of his everlasting worship, for your ally in this war? And do you impute your sins to the Romans, who to this day are concerned for our laws and are trying to force you to restore to God those sacrifices which you interrupted? Who would not bewail and lament for the city at this amazing inversion, where aliens and enemies rectify your impiety, while you, a Jew, nurtured in her laws, treat her even more harshly than your foes?" So he was extremely upset. He was a Jewish Pharisee. He was a priest himself, with the fact that they were desecrating the temple themselves, and they wouldn't offer the sacrifices like they were supposed to, and that they were doing the opposite of what they should be, and the Romans under Titus were actually trying to restore things to more normalcy, to bring the temple back online after this fight was over with. There is a there is an interesting passage that I can't find the exact quote for now, I'm afraid, where Titus himself begs the rebels to come out of the temple, to let the sacrifices begin again, and if they still wish to fight, to go elsewhere and then rejoin the battle, that he wanted to preserve this very special shrine. Now, he was not a worshiper, obviously, of the true God, but the Romans were committed as a people to allow freedom of worship as long as there was no disruption of the Roman government norm and that nobody rioted in the streets based on religion. And so that was the Romans' perspective on this. I want to just let you know that the way that it all ended, because I'm running out of time here, is that as the Roman forces broke through the walls and came closer and closer to the temple, the Jewish insurgents fought harder and harder amongst themselves and against the Romans. They set fire to a gate, and this gate then spread to some other very important areas of the temple building itself. The Romans dispatched some of their force in order to try to put the fire out, and those people were killed by the Jews, who would rather see the temple burn down than for the Romans to put the fire out. The final fire, which destroyed the temple, kind of started that way. Titus had met with his council of war. They knew that they were going to be able to take the temple the next day. And he listened to their suggestions. Some of them actually did suggest, let's destroy the temple because it's been a center of this revolt. But others counseled, no, there are plenty of Jews who have not been in revolt, who have been loyal to Rome, and this is a special place for them. And besides that, it's very beautiful and needs to be maintained. And Titus had decided to go with that sentiment, that they were going to storm the temple the next day and seize control. There was a fire still being fought during the middle of the night, and the Romans sent a small force out to stop it. They were attacked. They pushed the attacking Jewish force back. And in the confusion of the moment, some Roman soldier, not acting under official orders, picked up a piece of burning wood and threw it after the insurgents who had gone into the temple building. And it caught something on fire on the inside of the shrine. And the fire began. The Jewish people ran out. There was a very quick engagement, and most of those insurgents were then killed. And at that point, the Romans technically had control of the building. Titus was brought to the scene, explained to him what happened. He saw that the place was burning down. He tried to get people to fight the fire, but the fire was so loud as it was consuming the old wood that was in the paneling that he could hardly be heard. Plus, many of the Roman soldiers had already started getting their head on collecting the booty, which was theirs by right of war. And he just basically went into the temple building, looked around a little bit, and then came back out. And then they backed off and allowed the thing to be consumed. When it was done, after everything had cooled off, they pried all the stones apart to recover the gold and the silver which had melted. And the end result was that there was not one stone left upon another in the temple building, exactly as Jesus had predicted. And that is how the end of the Old Covenant came completely, and how the Olivet Discourse was fulfilled in AD 70 with the destruction of the temple.